This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents American Dirt by Janine Cummins. Narrated for you by Yareli Arismendi. Era la sed y el hambre, y tú fuiste la fruta. Era el duelo y las ruinas, y tú fuiste el milagro. There were thirst and hunger, and you were the fruit. There were grief and ruins, and you were the miracle. Pablo Neruda, The Song of Despair. Chapter 1. One of the very first bullets comes in through the open window above the toilet where Luca is standing. He doesn't immediately understand that it's a bullet at all, and it's only luck that it doesn't strike him between the eyes. Luca hardly registers the mild noise it makes as it flies past and lodges into the tiled wall behind him. But the wash of bullets that follows is loud, booming and thudding, clack-clacking with helicopter speed. There is a raft of screams, too, but that noise is short-lived, soon exterminated by the gunfire. Before Luca can zip his pants, lower the lid, climb up to look out, before he has time to verify the source of that terrible clamor, the bathroom door swings open and Mami is there.
Mi joven, she says, so quietly that Luca doesn't hear her.
Her hands are not gentle. She propels him toward the shower. He trips on the raised tile step and falls forward onto his hands. Mami lands on top of him and his teeth pierce his lip in the tumble. He tastes blood. One dark droplet makes a tiny circle of red against the bright green shower tile. Mami shoves Luca into the corner. There's no door on this shower, no curtain. It's only a corner of his abuela's bathroom with a third-tiled wall built to suggest a stall. This wall is around 5.5 feet high and 3 feet long, just large enough, with some luck, to shield Luca and his mother from sight. Luca's back is wedged, his small shoulders touching both walls. His knees are drawn up to his chin, and Mami is clinched around him like a tortoise's shell. The door of the bathroom remains open, which worries Luca, though he can't see it beyond the shield of his mother's body, behind the half-barricade of his abuela's shower wall. He'd like to wriggle out and tip that door lightly with his finger. He'd like to swing it shut. He doesn't know that his mother left it open on purpose, that a closed door only invites closer scrutiny. The clatter of gunfire outside continues, joined by an odor of charcoal and burning meat. Papi is grilling carne asada out there, and Luca's favorite chicken drumsticks. He likes them only a tiny bit blackened, the crispy tang of the skins. His mother pulls her head up long enough to look him in the eye. She puts her hands on both sides of his face and tries to cover his ears. Outside, the gunfire slows. It ceases and then returns in short bursts, mirroring, Luca thinks, the sporadic and wild rhythm of his heart. In between the racket, Luca can still hear the radio, a woman's voice announcing, La mejor 100.1 FM Acapulco, followed by Banda MS singing about how happy they are to be in love. Someone shoots the radio. And then there's laughter, men's voices. Two or three. Luca can't tell. Hard footsteps on Abuela's patio. Is he here? One of the voices is just outside the window. Here.
What about the kid?
Mira, there's a boy here.
This him?
Luca's cousin, Adrián. He's wearing cleats and his Hernández jersey. Adrián can juggle a balón de fútbol on his knees 47 times without dropping it.
I don't know. Looks the right age. Take a picture.
Hey, chicken, another voice says. Man, this looks good. You want some chicken?
Luca's head is beneath his mommy's chin, her body knotted tightly around him.
Forget the chicken, pendejo. Check the house.
Luca's mommy rocks in her squatting position, pushing Luca even harder into the tiled wall. She squeezes against him, and together they hear the squeak and bang of the back door. Footsteps in the kitchen. The intermittent rattle of bullets in the house. Mommy turns her head and notices, vivid against the tile floor, the lone spot of Luca's blood, illuminated by the slant of light from the window. Luca feels her breath snag in her chest. The house is quiet now. The hallway that ends at the door of this bathroom is carpeted. Mommy tugs her shirt sleeve over her hand, and Luca watches in horror as she leans away from him toward the telltale splatter of blood. She runs her sleeve over it, leaving behind only a faint smear, and then pitches back to him just as the man in the hallway uses the butt of his AK-47 to nudge the door the rest of the way open. There must be three of them, because Luca can still hear two voices in the yard. On the other side of the shower wall, the third man unzips his pants and empties his bladder into Abuela's toilet. Luca does not breathe. Mommy does not breathe. Their eyes are closed, their bodies motionless. Even their adrenaline is suspended within the calcified will of their stillness. The man hiccups, flushes, washes his hands. He dries them on Abuela's good yellow towel, the one she puts out only for parties. They don't move after the man leaves, even after they hear the squeak and bang once more of the kitchen door. They stay there, fixed in their tight knot of arms and legs and knees and chins and clenched eyelids and locked fingers, even after they hear the man join his compatriots outside, after they hear him announce that the house is clear and he's going to eat some chicken now, because there's no excuse for letting good barbecue go to waste, not when there are children starving in Africa. The man is still close enough outside the window that Luca can hear the moist, rubbery smacking sounds his mouth makes with the chicken. Luca concentrates on breathing, in and out without sound. He tells himself that this is just a bad dream, a terrible dream, but one he's had many times before. He always awakens, heart pounding, and finds himself flooded with relief. It was just a dream. Because these are the modern boogeymen of urban Mexico. Because even parents who take care not to discuss the violence in front of them, to change the radio station when there's news of another shooting, to conceal the worst of their own fears, cannot prevent their children from talking to other children. On the swings, at the football field, in the boys' bathroom at school, the gruesome stories gather and swell. These kids, rich, poor, middle class, have all seen bodies in the streets, casual murder, and they know from talking to one another that there's a hierarchy of danger, that some families are at greater risk than others. So although Luca never saw the least scrap of evidence of that risk from his parents, even though they demonstrated their courage impeccably before their son, he knew. He knew this day would come. But that truth does nothing to soften its arrival. It's a long, long while before Luca's mother removes the clamp of her hand from the back of his neck, before she leans back far enough for him to notice that the angle of light falling through the bathroom window has changed. There's a blessing in the moments after terror and before confirmation. When at last he moves his body, Luca experiences a brief, lurching exhilaration at the very fact of his being alive. For a moment, he enjoys the ragged passage of breath through his chest. He places his palms flat to feel the cool press of tiles beneath his skin. Mommy collapses against the wall across from him and works her jaw in a way that reveals the dimple in her left cheek. It's weird to see her good church shoes in the shower. Luca touches the cut on his lip. The blood has dried there, but he scratches it with his teeth and it opens again. He understands that, were this a dream, he would not taste blood. At length, Mommy stands. "Stay here," she instructs him in a whisper. "Don't move until I come back for you. Don't make a sound, you understand?" Luca lunges for her hand. "Mommy, don't go." "Mijo, I will be right back, okay? You stay here." Mommy pries Luca's finger from her hand. "Don't move," she says again. "Good boy." Luca finds it easy to obey his mother's directive, not so much because he's an obedient child, but because he doesn't want to see. His whole family out there, in Abuela's backyard. Today is Saturday, April 7th, his cousin Jennifer's quinceañera, her 15th birthday party. She's wearing a long white dress. Her father and mother are there. Tio Alex and Tia Yemi, and Jennifer's younger brother, Adrián, who, because he already turned 9, likes to say he's a year older than Luca, even though they're really only 4 months apart. Before Luca had to pee, he and Adrián had been kicking the balón around with their other primos. The mothers had been sitting around the table at the patio, their iced palomas sweating on their napkins. The last time they were all together at Abuela's house, Jennifer had accidentally walked in on Luca in the bathroom, and Luca was so mortified that today he made Mommy come with him and stand guard outside the door. Abuela didn't like it. She told Mommy she was coddling him, that a boy his age should be able to go to the bathroom by himself. But Luca is an only child, so he gets away with things other kids don't. In any case, Luca is alone in the bathroom now, and he tries not to think it, but the thought swarms up unbidden. Those irritable words Mommy and Abuela exchanged were perhaps the very last ones between them, ever. Luca had approached the table wriggling, whispered into Mommy's ear, and Abuela, seeing this, had shaken her head, wagged an admonishing finger at them both, passed her remarks. She had a way of smiling when she criticized, but Mommy was always on Luca's side. She rolled her eyes and pushed her chair back from the table anyway, ignoring her mother's disapproval. When was that? 10 minutes ago? 2 hours? Luca feels unmoored from the boundaries of time that have always existed. Outside the window, he hears Mommy's tentative footsteps, the soft scuff of her shoe through the remnants of something broken. A solitary gasp, too windy to be called a sob. Then a quickening of sound as she crosses the patio with purpose, depresses the keys on her phone. When she speaks, her voice has a stretched quality that Luca has never heard before, high and tight in the back of her throat. "Send help." Chapter 2. By the time Mommy returns to pull Luca from the shower, he's curled into a tight ball and rocking himself. She tells him to stand, but he shakes his head and rolls himself up even tighter, his body flapping with panicked reluctance. As long as he stays here in the shower with his face lowered into the dark angles of his elbows, as long as he doesn't look Mommy in the face, he can put off knowing what he already knows. He can prolong the moment of irrational hope that maybe some sliver of yesterday's world is still intact. It might be better for him to go and look, to see the brilliant splatters of color on Yennefer's white dress, to see Adrienne's eyes open to the sky, to see Abuela's gray hair matted with stuff that should never exist outside the neat encasement of a skull. It might be good, actually, for Luca to see the warm wreckage of his recent father, the spatula bent crooked beneath his fallen weight, his blood still leaching across the concrete patio. Because none of it, however horrific, is worse than the images Luca will conjure instead with the radiance of his own imagination. When at last she gets him to stand, Mommy takes Luca out the front door, which may or may not be the best idea. If los sicarios were to return, what would be worse? To be on the street in plain sight, or to be hidden inside where no one might witness their arrival? An impossible question. Nothing is better or worse than anything else now. They walk across Abuela's tidy courtyard, and Mommy opens the gate. Together, they sit on the yellow-painted curb with their feet on the street. The far side is in shade, but it's bright here, and the sun is hot against Luca's forehead. After some brief swell of minutes, they hear sirens approaching. Mommy, whose name is Lydia, becomes aware that her teeth are chattering. She's not cold. Her armpits are damp, and she has goosebumps across the flesh of her arms. Luca leans forward and retches once. He brings up a glob of potato salad, stained pink with fruit punch. It splats onto the asphalt between his feet, but he and his mother don't move away from it. They don't even seem to notice. Nor do they note the furtive rearrangement of curtains and blinds in nearby windows as the neighbors prepare their credible deniability. What Luca does notice is the walls that line his abuela's street. He's seen them countless times before, but today he perceives a difference. Each house here is fronted by a small courtyard like abuela's, hidden from the street by a wall like abuela's, topped with razor wire or chicken wire or spiked fence posts like abuela's, and accessible only through a locked gate like abuela's. Acapulco is a dangerous city. The people take precautions here, even in nice neighborhoods like this one, especially in nice neighborhoods like this one. But what good are those protections when the men come? Luca leans his head against his mother's shoulder, and she puts an arm around him. She doesn't ask if he's okay, because from now on, that question will carry a weight of painful absurdity. Lydia tries her best not to consider the many words that will never come out of her mouth now, the sudden monster void of words she will never get to say. When they arrive, the police pull yellow Escena del Crimen tape across both ends of the block to discourage traffic and make room for the macabre motorcade of emergency vehicles. There are a lot of officers, a whole army of them, who move around and pass Luca and Lydia with choreographed reverence. When the senior detective approaches and begins asking questions, Lydia hesitates for a moment, considering where to send Luca. He's too young to hear everything she needs to say. She should dispatch him to someone else for a few minutes, so she can give forthright answers to these dreadful questions. She should send him to his father, her mother, her sister Yemi. But they are all dead in the backyard, their bodies as closed as toppled dominoes. It's all meaningless anyway. The police aren't here to help. Lydia begins to sob. Luca stands and places the cold curve of his hand across the back of his mother's neck. Give her a minute, he says, like a grown man. When the detective returns, there's a woman with him, the medical examiner, who addresses Luca directly. She puts a hand on his shoulder and asks if he'd like to sit in her truck. It says Semefo on the side, and the back doors are standing open. Mommy nods at him, So Luca goes with the woman and sits inside, dangling his feet over the back bumper. She offers him a sweating can, a cold refresco. Lydia's brain, which had been temporarily suspended by shock, begins working again, but it creeps like sludge. She's still sitting on the curb, and the detective stands between her and her son.
"Did you see the shooter?" he asks.
"Shooters, plural. I think there were three of them." She wishes the detective would step aside so she can keep Luca in her line of sight. He's only a dozen steps away.
"You saw them?"
"No, we heard them. We were hiding in the shower. One came in and took a piss while we were in there. Maybe you can get fingerprints from the faucet." He washed his hands. "Can you believe that?" Lydia claps her hands loudly, as if to scare off the memory. "There were at least two more voices outside."
"Did they say or do anything that might help identify them?"
She shakes her head. "One ate the chicken." The detective writes "pollo" in his notebook. "One asked if he was here."
"A specific target? Did they say who he was? A name?"
"They didn't have to. It was my husband."
The detective stops writing and looks at her expectantly.
"Your husband is..."
"Sebastián Pérez Delgado."
"The reporter?"
Lydia nods, and the detective whistles through his teeth.
"He's here?"
She nods again.
"On the patio, with a spatula, with a sign."
"I'm sorry, señora. Your husband received many threats, yes?"
"Yes, but not recently."
"And what exactly was the nature of those threats?"
"They told him to stop writing about the cartels."
"Or?"
"Or they would kill his whole family." Her voice is flat. The detective takes a deep breath and looks at Lydia with what might be interpreted as sympathy.
"When was the last time he was threatened?"
Lydia shakes her head.
"I don't know. A long time ago. This wasn't supposed to happen. It wasn't supposed to happen."
The detective folds his lips into a thin line and remains silent.
"They're going to kill me too,"
she says, understanding only as these words emerge that they might be true. The detective does not move to contradict her. Unlike many of his colleagues, he's not sure which ones, but it doesn't matter. He happens not to be on the cartel payroll. He trusts no one. In fact, of the more than two dozen law enforcement and medical personnel moving around Abuela's home and patio this very moment, marking the locations of shell casings, examining footprints, analyzing blood splatter, taking pictures, checking for pulses, making the sign of the cross over the corpses of Lydia's family, seven receive regular money from the local cartel. The illicit payment is three times more than what they earn from the government. In fact, one has already texted El Jefe to report Lydia's and Luca's survival. The others do nothing, because that's precisely what the cartel pays them to do, to populate uniforms and perform the appearance of governance. Some of the personnel feel morally conflicted about this. Others do not. None of them have a choice anyway, so their feelings are largely immaterial. The unsolved crime rate in Mexico is well north of 90%. The costumed existence of La Policía provides the necessary counter-illusion to the fact of the cartel's actual impunity. Lydia knows this. Everyone knows this. She decides presently that she must get out of here. She stands up from her position on the curb and is surprised by the strength of her legs beneath her. The detective steps back to give her space.
"When he realizes I've survived, they will return."
And then the memory comes back to her like a throb,
one of the voices in the yard asking, "What about the kid?"
Lydia's joints feel like water. "He's going to murder my son."
"He?" the detective says. "You know specifically who did this?"
"Are you kidding me?"
she asks.
"There's only one possible perpetrator for a bloodbath of this magnitude in Acapulco, and everyone knows who the man is.
Javier Crespo Fuentes. Her friend. Why should she say his name out loud?" The detective's question is either a stage play or a test. He writes more words in his notebook. He writes, "La lechuza." He writes, "Los jardineros." And then shows the notebook to Lydia.
"I can't do this right now." She pushes past him.
"Please, just a few more questions."
"No.
No more questions. Zero more questions."
There are 16 bodies in the backyard, almost everyone Lydia loved in the world. But she still feels on the precipice of this information. She knows it to be factual because she heard them die. She saw their bodies. She touched her mother's still warm hand and felt the absence of her husband's pulse when she lifted his wrist. But her mind is still trying to rewind it, to undo it, because it can't really be true. It's too horrific to be actually true. Panic feels imminent, but it doesn't descend.
"Luca, come."
She reaches out her hand, and Luca hops down from the medical examiner's truck. He leaves the still full refresco on the back bumper. Lydia grabs him, and together they walk down the street to where Sebastian parked their car, near the end of the block. The detective follows, still trying to speak to her. He doesn't accept that she has quit the conversation. Was she not clear enough? She stops walking so abruptly, he almost stumbles into her back. He draws up on his tiptoes to avoid a collision. She spins on her foot.
"I need his keys," she says.
"Keys?
My husband's car keys."
The detective continues speaking as Lydia pushes past him again, pulling Luca along behind her. She goes back through the gate into Abuela's courtyard and tells Luca to wait. Then she thinks better of it and brings him into the house. She sits him on Abuela's gold velveteen couch with instructions not to move.
"Can you stay with him, please?"
The detective nods. Lydia pauses momentarily at the back door and then squares her shoulders before pushing it open and stepping out. In the shade of the backyard, there's the sweet odor of lime and sticky charred sauce, and Lydia knows she will never eat barbecue again. Some of her family members are covered now, and there are little bright yellow placards set up around the yard with black letters and numbers on them. The placards mark the locations of evidence that will never be used to seek a conviction. The placards make everything worse. Their presence means it's real. Lydia is aware of her lungs inside her body. They feel raw and raggedy, a sensation she's never experienced before. She steps toward Sebastian, who hasn't moved, his left arm still bent awkwardly beneath him, the spatula jutting out from beneath his hip. The way he's splayed there reminds Lydia of the shapes his body makes when he's at his most vividly animated, when he wrestles with Luca in the living room after dinner. They squeal, they roar, they bang into the furniture. Lydia runs soapy water into the kitchen sink and rolls her eyes at them. But all that heat is gone now. There's a ticking stillness beneath Sebastian's skin. She wants to talk to him before all his color is gone. She wants to tell him what happened, hurriedly, desperately. Some manic part of her believes that if she tells the story well enough, she can convince him not to be dead. She can convince him of her need for him, of the greatness of their son's need for him. There's a kind of paralyzed insanity in her throat.
Someone has removed the cardboard sign the gunman left weighted on his chest with a simple rock. The sign in green marker said, "Toda mi familia está muerta por mi culpa." My whole family is dead because of me. Lydia crouches at her husband's feet, but she doesn't want to feel the cooling of his pallid skin. Proof. She grabs the toe of one shoe and closes her eyes. He's still mostly intact, and she feels grateful for that. She knows a cardboard sign could have been affixed to his heart with the blade of a machete. She knows that the relative neatness of his death is a sort of deformed kindness. She's seen other crime scenes, nightmarish scenes, bodies that are no longer bodies, but only parts of bodies, mutilados. When the cartel murders, it does so to set an example for exaggerated, grotesque illustration. One morning at work, as she opened her shop for the day, Lydia saw a boy she knew down the street kneeling to unlock the grate of his father's shoe store with a key dangling by a shoelace around his neck. He was 16 years old. When the car pulled up, the kid couldn't run because the key snagged in the lock. It caught him by the neck. So los sicarios lifted the grate and hung the kid by the shoelace, by the neck, and then pummeled him until all he could do was twitch. Lydia had rushed inside and locked the door behind her, so she didn't see when they pulled down his pants and added the decoration. But she heard about it later. They all did. And every shop owner in the neighborhood knew that that kid's father had refused to pay the cartel's mordidas. So yes, Lydia is grateful that 16 of her loved ones were killed by the quick clinical dispatch of bullets. The officers in the yard avert their eyes from her, and she feels grateful for that too. The crime scene photographer sets his camera down on the table beside the drink that still bears a smudge of Lydia's truffle-colored lipstick on its rim. The ice cubes have melted inside, and there's a small puddle of condensation on the napkin around her glass. It's still wet, and that feels impossible to Lydia, that her life could be shattered so completely in less time than it takes for a ring of condensation to evaporate into the atmosphere. She's aware that a deferential hush has fallen over the patio. She moves to Sebastian's side without standing. She crawls on her hands and knees and then hesitates, staring at his one outstretched hand, the ridges and lines of his knuckles, the perfect half moons of his nail beds. The fingers do not move. The wedding band is inert. His eyes are closed. And Lydia wonders, absurdly, if he closed them on purpose, for her, a final act of tenderness, so that when she found him, she wouldn't have to observe the vacancy there. She claps a hand over her mouth because she has a feeling the essential part of herself might fall out. She shoves the feeling down, tucks her fingers into the fold of that unresponsive hand, and allows herself to lean gently across his chest. He is cold already. He is cold. Sebastian is gone. And what's left is only the beloved, familiar shape of him, empty of breath. She places her hand on his jaw, his chin. She closes her mouth very tightly and places her palm against the coolness of his forehead. The first time she ever saw him, he was slouched over a spiral notebook in a library in Mexico City, pen in hand. The tilt of his shoulders, the fullness of his mouth. He was wearing a purple t-shirt, some band she didn't know. She understands now that it wasn't the body, but the way he animated it that had thrilled her. The flagstones press into her knees while she covers him with prayers. Her tears are spasmodic. The bent spatula sits in a puddle of congealed blood, and the flat part still bears a smudge of uncooked meat. Lydia fights a roll of nausea, slips her hand into her husband's pocket, and retrieves his keys. How many times during their life together has she slipped her hand into his pocket? Don't think it. Don't think it. Don't think. It's difficult to remove his wedding ring. The loose skin of his knuckles scrunches up beneath the band, so she has to twist it. She has to use one hand to straighten his finger and the other to twist the ring. And in this way, at last, she has his wedding band, the one she placed on his finger at the Catedral de Nuestra Señora de la Soledad more than 10 years ago. She slips it onto her thumb, places both hands on the crate of his chest, and pushes herself to her feet. She lurches away, waiting for someone to challenge her for the items she took. She almost wants someone to say she can't have them, that she can't tamper with evidence or some horseshit like that. How satisfying it might be, momentarily, to have a direct receptacle for some lashing belt of her rage. No one dares. Lydia stands with her shoulders loose to the earth, her mother. She moves toward Abuela, whose body is one of those now loosely covered with black plastic. An officer steps to intercept her.
Señora, please, he says simply.
Lydia looks at him wildly.
I need a last moment with my mother.
He shakes his head once, the slightest movement. His voice is soft.
I assure you, he says, that is not your mother.
Lydia blinks, unmoving, her husband's car keys gripped in the vise of her hand. He's right. She could spend more time in this landscape of carnage. But why? They are all gone. This is not what she wants to remember of them. She turns away from the 16 horizontal shapes in the yard, and with a squeak and a bang, passes through the doorway into the kitchen. Outside, the officials resume their activities. Lydia opens the closet in her mother's bedroom and withdraws Abuela's solitary piece of luggage, a small red overnight bag. Lydia unzips it and finds that it's full of smaller purses. It's a bag of bags. She dumps them on the bed, opens her mother's nightstand, pulls a rosary and a small prayer book from the drawer, and puts them in the overnight bag along with Sebastián's keys. Then she stoops down and sticks her arm beneath her mother's mattress. She sweeps it back and forth until her fingertips brush a fold of paper. Lydia pulls the wad out, almost 15,000 pesos. She puts them in the bag. She throws the pile of small purses back in her mother's closet, takes the bag to the bathroom, opens a medicine cabinet, and grabs what she can. A hairbrush, a toothbrush, toothpaste, moisturizer, a tube of lip balm, a pair of tweezers. They all go into the bag. She does all this without thinking, without really considering which items might be helpful or useless. She does it because she can't think of what else to do. Lydia and her mother are the same shoe size, a small blessing. Lydia takes the only pair of comfortable shoes from her mother's closet, quilted gold lamé sneakers with a zipper on one side that Abuela wore for gardening. In the kitchen, the raid continues. A sleeve of cookies, a tin of peanuts, two bags of chips, all surreptitiously stuffed into the bag. Her mother's purse hangs on a hook behind the kitchen door, alongside two other hooks that hold Abuela's apron and her favorite teal sweater. Lydia takes the purse down and looks inside. It feels like opening her mother's mouth. It's too personal in there. Lydia takes the whole thing, folds the softened brown leather into the end pocket of the overnight bag, and sips it in. The detective is sitting beside Luca on the couch when Lydia returns, but he's not asking questions. His pad and pencil are resigned on the coffee table.
We have to go, she says.
Luca stands without waiting to be told. The detective stands too. I must caution you against returning home right now, señora, he says. It may not be safe. If you wait here, perhaps one of my men can drive you. We might find a secure location for you and your son. Lydia smiles, and there's a brief astonishment that her face can still make those shapes. A small puff of laughter. I like our chances better without your assistance. The detective frowns at her but nods. You have somewhere safe to go? Please, don't concern yourself with our well-being, she says. Serve justice. Worry about that. She's aware that the words are leaving her mouth, like tiny, unpoisoned darts, as futile as they are angry. She makes no effort to censor herself. The detective stands with his hands in his pockets and frowns toward the floor. I'm so sorry for your loss, truly. I know how it must look. Every murder going unsolved, but there are people who still care, who are horrified by this violence. Please know, I will try. He too understands the uselessness of his words, but he feels compelled to tender them nonetheless. He reaches into his breast pocket and pulls out a card with his name and phone number on it. We will need an official statement when you're feeling up to it. Take a few days if you need. He proffers the card, but Lydia makes no move to take it, so Luca reaches up and grabs it. He's maneuvered himself in close beside his mother, laced one arm behind her through the strap of the red overnight bag. This time, the detective doesn't follow them. Their shadows move as one lumpy beast along the sidewalk. Beneath the windshield wiper of their car, an instantly recognizable orange 1974 Volkswagen Beetle, there is a tiny slip of paper, so small that it doesn't even flit in the hot breeze that gusts up the street.
Carajo! Lydia curses, automatically pushing Luca behind her.
What, mommy?
Stay here. No, go stand over there.
She points back in the direction from which they came, and for once, Luca doesn't argue. He scuttles up the street, a dozen paces or more. Lydia drops the overnight bag at her feet on the sidewalk, takes a step back from the car, looks up and down the street. Her heart doesn't race. It feels laden within her. Her husband's parking permit is glued to the windshield, and there's a smattering of rust across the back bumper. She steps into the street, leans over to see if she can read the paper without lifting it. A news van is parked just beyond the yellow crime scene tape at the far end of the block, but its reporter and cameraman are busy with preparations and haven't noticed them. She turns her back and tugs the slip of paper free from the wiper. One word in green marker. Boo. Her quick intake of breath feels like a slice through the core of her body. She looks back at Luca, crumbles the paper in her fist, and jams it into her pocket. They have to disappear. They have to get away from Acapulco, so far away that Javier Crespo Fuentes will never be able to find them. They cannot drive the car. Chapter 3. Lydia circles the orange Beetle twice, glancing through the windows, inspecting the tires, the gas tank, what she can't see of the undercarriage by stooping down without touching anything. Nothing appears different from how they left it. Not that she was paying much attention. She stands back and crosses her arms over her chest. She won't dare to drive it, but she must at least open it to retrieve some of their belongings from inside. That need feels urgent, but her mind cannot reach beyond the immediate present, so she doesn't get as far as the word keepsakes. She peers through the window and sees Sebastian's backpack on the passenger side floor, her own sunglasses glinting on the dashboard. Luca's yellow and blue sweatshirt sprawled on the back seat. It's too dangerous to go home now, to the place where they all live together. She needs to be quick, to get Luca out of here. For a brief moment, Lydia considers that if there's a bomb in the car, it might be kinder to take Luca with her, to call him over here now, before she opens the door. But her maternal instinct defeats this macabre idea. So she approaches with a key shaking in her hand, using the other hand to steady it. She looks at Luca, who gives her a thumbs up. There won't be a bomb, she tells herself. A bomb would be overkill after all those bullets. She pushes the key into the lock. One deep breath. Two. She turns the key. Thunk. The sound of the door unlocking is almost enough to finish her. But then silence. No ticking, no beeping, no whoosh of murderous air. She closes her eyes, pivots, returns Lucas' thumbs up. She swings the creaky door open and begins rummaging inside. What does she need? She stops short, her confusion momentarily paralyzing. This cannot be real, she thinks. Her mind feels stretched and warped. Lydia remembers her mother walking in circles for weeks after her papi died. From sink to fridge, sink to fridge. She'd stand with her hand on the tap and forget to turn it on. Lydia can't do a suspended loop like that. There is danger. They have to move. Sebastian's backpack is here. She must pick it up. She needs to accomplish the tasks immediately before her. There will be time later to begin the work of comprehending how this could have happened, why it happened. She opens her husband's backpack, takes out a sloshing thermos, his glasses, the keys to his office, his headphones, three small notebooks, and a fistful of cheap pens, a handheld tape recorder, and his press credentials, and places everything on the passenger seat. Her husband's Samsung Galaxy Tab and charger she keeps, though she powers the tablet all the way down before returning it to the now empty backpack. She doesn't understand how GPS works in these devices, but she doesn't want to be trackable. She retrieves her sunglasses from the dashboard and shoves them onto her face, almost stabbing herself in the eye with one outstretched stem. She pushes the seat forward to see what's in back. Luca's church shoes are on the floor, where he left them when he changed into his sneakers to play football with Adrian. Oh my God, Adrian, Lydia thinks, and the cleft feeling in her chest opens deeper, as if there's an axe hacked into her sternum. She squeezes her eyes closed for just a moment and forces a cycle of breath through her body. She lifts Luca's shoes and places them into the backpack. Sebastian's red New York Yankees hat is on the back seat too. She grabs it, climbs out of the car, and tosses it to Luca, who puts it on. In the trunk, she finds Sebastian's good brown cardigan, which she shoves into the bag. There's also a basketball, which she leaves, and a dirty t-shirt, which she keeps. She slams the trunk, walks back to the front seat to select one of his notebooks, not yet allowing herself to consider the reason she does this, to retain a personal record of his extinct handwriting. She chooses one at random, places it in the backpack, and then locks the doors behind her. Luca comes to stand beside her before she beckons him. My son is fundamentally altered, she thinks. The way he watches her and interprets her wishes without command. Where will we go, mommy? Lydia gives him a sideways glance. 8 years old. She must reach past this obliteration and find the strength to salvage what she can. She kisses the top of his head, and they begin to walk, away from the reporters, away from the orange car, Abuela's house, their annihilated life. I don't know, mijo, she says. We'll see. We'll have an adventure. Like in the movies? Yes, mijo, just like in the movies. She slings the backpack onto both shoulders and tightens the straps before hoisting the overnight bag too. They walk several blocks north, then hang a left toward the beach, then turn south again, because Lydia can't decide if they should be somewhere crowded with tourists or if they should try to stay out of sight altogether. She frequently looks over her shoulder, studies the drivers of the passing cars, tightens her grip on Luca's hand. At an open gate, a mutt barks at them, lunging and nipping. A woman in a drab floral dress comes out of the house to correct the dog, but before she can get there, Lydia kicks it savagely and feels no guilt for having done so. The woman yells after her, but Lydia keeps moving, holding Luca by the hand. Luca adjusts the brim of his father's too big Yankees hat. Papi's sweat is seeped into the hat band, so little currents of his scent puff out whenever Luca pulls it to one side or the other, which Luca does now at regular intervals so he can smell his father. Then he has the idea that perhaps the scent is finite, and he fears he might use it all up, so he stops touching it. At length, they spot a bus and decide to get on. It's mid-afternoon on a Saturday, and the bus isn't crowded. Luca feels glad to sit, until he realizes that the movement of his legs beneath him, carrying the weight of his small frame through the streets of his city, had been the thing staving off the crush of horror that now threatens to descend. As soon as he's seated beside Mommy on the blue plastic seat, his tired legs dangling down, he begins to think. He begins to shake. Mommy puts her arm around him and squeezes tight.
"You cannot cry here, mijito," Mommy says. "Not yet."
Luca nods, and just like that, he stops trembling, and the risk of tears evaporates. He leans his head against the warm glass of the bus window and looks out. He focuses on the cartoon colors of his city, the green of the palm fronds, the trunks of the trees painted white to discourage beetles, the vivid blare of signs advertising shops and hotels and shoes. At El Rollo, Luca looks at the children and teenagers in line for the ticket window. They wear flip-flops and have towels around their necks. Behind them, the red and yellow water slides swoop and soar. Luca puts one finger against the glass and squashes the children in line one by one. The bus squeaks its brakes at the curb, and three damp-haired teenage boys get on. They pass Luca and Lydia without a glance and sit in the back of the bus, elbows planted on knees, talking quietly across the aisle. "Papi's going to take me in the summertime," Luca says.
"What?"
"To El Rollo. He said this summer we could go. He would take a day off work one time when I'm not in school." Lydia sucks in her cheeks and bites down. A disloyal reflex. She's angry at her husband. The driver closes the door and the bus moves off with the traffic. Lydia unzips the overnight bag at her feet, kicks off her heels, and replaces them with her mother's quilted gold sneakers. She doesn't have a plan, which is unlike her, and she finds it difficult to form one because her mind feels unfamiliar, both frenetic and swampy. She does have the wherewithal to remember that every 15 or 20 minutes, they should get off and change buses, which they do. Sometimes they change direction, sometimes they don't. One bus stops directly in front of a church, so they go briefly inside, but the part of Lydia that's usually available for prayer has shut down. She's experienced this numbness a few times before in her life. When she was 17 and her father died of cancer. When she had a late-stage miscarriage 2 years after Luca. When the doctors told her she could never have more children. So she doesn't think of it as a crisis of faith. Instead, she believes it's a divine kindness. Like a government furlough, God has deferred her non-essential agencies. Outside, Luca vomits on the pavement once more while they wait for the next bus. Around her neck, Lydia wears a thin gold chain adorned only with three interlocking loops. It's a discreet piece of jewelry, and the only one she wears apart from the filigreed gold band around the fourth finger of her left hand. Sebastian gave her the necklace the first Christmas after Luca was born, and she loved it immediately. The symbolism of it. She's worn it every day since, and it's become so much a part of her that she's woven her mannerisms into it. When she's bored, she runs the delicate chain back and forth along the pad of her thumb. When she's nervous, she has a habit of looping the three interlocking circles together onto the tip of her pinky nail, where they make a faint tinkling sound. She doesn't touch these golden hoops now. Her hand moves absently toward her neck, but already she's aware of the gesture. Already she's training herself to disguise old habits. She must become entirely unrecognizable if she hopes to survive. She opens the clasp at the back of her neck and slips Sebastian's wedding ring from her thumb onto the chain. Then she refastens the clasp around her neck and drops the whole thing inside the collar of her blouse. They must avoid drawing the attention of the bus drivers, who've been known to act as halcones, lookouts for the cartel. Lydia understands that her appearance as a moderately attractive but not beautiful woman of indeterminate age, traveling the city with an unremarkable-looking boy, can provide a kind of natural camouflage if she takes care to promote the impression that they're simply out for a day's shopping or a visit to friends across the city. Indeed, Luca and Lydia could easily change places with many of their fellow passengers, which Lydia thinks of as truly absurd, that the people around them cannot see plainly what abomination they've just endured. It feels as evident to Lydia as if she were carrying a flashing neon sign. She fights at every moment against the scream that pulses inside her like a living thing. It stretches and kicks in her gut like Luca did when he was a baby in there. With tremendous self-control, she strangles and suppresses it. When a plan finally does begin to emerge from the violent fog of chaos in her mind, Lydia feels uncertain whether it's a good one, but she commits herself to it because she has no other. At 4:15, just before closing time in Playa Caletilla, Lydia and Luca disembark from the bus, go into an unfamiliar branch of their bank, and wait in line. Lydia turns on her cell phone to check her balance and then powers it all the way off again before filling out a withdrawal slip for almost the full amount, 219,803 pesos, or about $12,500, almost all of it an inheritance from Sebastian's godfather, who'd owned a bottling company and who'd never had children of his own. She asks for the money in large bills. A few minutes later, Luca and Lydia are back on the bus, their life savings in cash stuffed into three envelopes at the bottom of Abuela's overnight bag. Three buses and more than an hour later, they get out at the Walmart in Diamante. They buy a backpack for Luca, two packets of underwear, two pairs of jeans, two packets of three plain white t-shirts, socks, two hooded sweatshirts, two warm jackets, two more toothbrushes, disposable wipes, band-aids, sunscreen, Blistex, a first aid kit, two canteens, two flashlights, some batteries, and a map of Mexico. Lydia takes a long time selecting a machete at the counter in the home goods department, eventually choosing a small one with a retractable blade and a tidy black holster she can strap to her leg. It's not a gun, but it's better than nothing. They pay in cash and then walk beneath the highway overpass toward the beach hotels, Luca wearing Papi's baseball cap and Lydia not touching her gold necklace. She watches everyone as they walk, other pedestrians, drivers in passing cars, even skinny boys on their skateboards, because she knows halcones are everywhere. They hurry on. Lydia chooses the Hotel Duquesa Imperial because of its size. It's big enough to provide a measure of anonymity, but not new enough to attract much in the way of trendy social attention. She requests a room facing the street and pays, again in cash.
And now I just need a credit card on file for incidentals, the desk clerk says as he tucks two card keys into a paper sleeve.
Lydia looks at the keys and considers snatching them, bolting for the elevator. Then she opens the overnight bag and pretends to rummage for her credit card.
Shoot, I must have left it in the car, she says.
How much is the hold?
4,000 pesos.
He gives her a clinical smile. Fully refundable, of course.
Of course, Lydia says.
She props the overnight bag up on her knee and flips open one of the envelopes. She withdraws the 4,000 pesos without taking the envelope out of the bag.
Cash is okay?
Oh. The clerk looks mildly alarmed and darts his eyes toward his manager, who's busy with another customer.
Cash is fine, the manager says without looking up from his task.
The clerk nods at Lydia, who presses the four pink bills into his hand. He puts them into an envelope and seals it.
And your name, please?
His black pen hovers over the front of the envelope. Lydia hesitates for a moment.
Fermina Dessa, she says,
the first name that comes to mind.
He hands her the room key. Enjoy your stay, Ms. Dessa.
The ride in the elevator to the 10th floor feels like the longest minute and a half of Luca's life. His feet hurt, his back hurts, his neck hurts, and he still hasn't cried. A family gets on at the 4th floor and then realizes the elevator is going up, so they get off again. The parents are laughing with each other, holding hands while their kids bicker. The boy looks at Luca and sticks his tongue out as the elevator doors close. Luca knows by instinct and by mommy's subtle cues that he must behave as if everything's normal. And he's managed that behemoth task so far. But there's an elegant older woman in the elevator, too. And she's admiring mommy's quilted gold shoes. Abuela's shoes. Luca blinks rapidly.
How beautiful your shoes, so unusual, the woman says, touching Lydia lightly on the arm. Where did you buy them?
Lydia looks down at her feet instead of turning to engage with the woman.
Oh, I don't remember, she says. They're so old.
And then she stabs the 10 button repeatedly with her finger, which doesn't speed up the elevator, but does have the intended effect of silencing any further attempts at conversation. The woman gets off on the 6th floor, and after she does so, mommy hits numbers 14, 18, and 19 as well. They get off at 10 and walk 3 flights down to the 7th floor. A surprising thing happens to Luca after mommy finally opens the door of their hotel room with her card key, after she looks both ways up and down the carpeted corridor and ushers him quickly inside, after she deadbolts and chain locks the door, dragging the desk chair across the tiled floor and wedging it beneath the doorknob. The surprising thing that happens to him is nothing. The cloudburst of anguish he's been struggling against does not come. Neither does it go. It remains there, pent up like a held breath, hovering just on the periphery of his mind. He has the sense that were he to turn his head, were he to poke at the globular nightmare ever so gently with his finger, it would unleash a torrent so colossal he would be swept away forever. Luca takes care to hold himself quite still. Then he kicks off his shoes and climbs up on the edge of the lone bed. A towel has been placed there, folded into the shape of a swan, which Luca takes by the long neck and thrashes to the floor. He clutches the remote control like it's a life preserver and clicks the television on. Mommy moves their Walmart bags, backpacks, and Abuela's overnight bag to the small table, and dumps everything out. She begins removing tags, organizing items into piles, and then quite suddenly, she sits down hard in one of the chairs and doesn't move for at least 10 minutes. Luca doesn't look at her. He glues his eyes to Nickelodeon, turns Henry Danger up loud. When at last she begins to move again, Mommy comes to him and kisses his forehead roughly. She crosses the room and slides open the door to the balcony. She doubts there's any amount of fresh air that could succeed in clearing her head, but she has to try. She leaves it open and steps outside. If there's one good thing about terror, Lydia now understands, it's that it's more immediate than grief. She knows that she will soon have to contend with what's happened, but for now, the possibility of what might still happen serves to anesthetize her from the worst of the anguish. She peers over the edge of the balcony and surveys the street below. She tells herself there's no one out there. She tells herself they are safe. Downstairs in the lobby, the front desk clerk excuses himself from his post and heads for the employee break room. In the second stall of the bathroom, he removes a burner phone from his interior suit jacket pocket and sends the following text. 2 special guests just checked in to the Hotel Duquesa Imperial. Chapter 4. On the occasion of their first encounter, Javier Crespo Fuentes arrived alone at Lydia's shop on a Tuesday morning just as she was setting her chalkboard on the sidewalk outside. That week, she'd selected 10 books from faraway places to promote with a hand-chalked sign that read, "Books, cheaper than airline tickets." She was holding the door open with one leg as she lifted the sign through, and then he appeared, approaching quickly to help with the door. The bell above them jangled like a pronouncement. "Thank you," Lydia said. He nodded. "But far more dangerous." She frowned and propped open the easel. "I'm sorry?" "The sign," he gestured, and she stood back to assess her lettering. "Books are cheaper than traveling, but they're also more dangerous." Lydia smiled. "Well, I suppose that depends on where you travel." They went inside and she left him to his own counsel while he browsed the stacks. But when at last he approached the counter and set his books beside the register, she was startled by his selections. Lydia had owned this store for almost 10 years, and she'd stocked it with both books she loved and books she wasn't crazy about, but knew would sell. She also kept a healthy inventory of note cards, pens, calendars, toys, games, reading glasses, magnets, and keychains. And it was that kind of merchandise, along with the splashy bestsellers, that made her shop profitable. So it had long been a secret pleasure of Lydia's that hidden among all the more popular goods, she was able to make a home for some of her best-loved secret treasures. Gems that had blown open her mind and changed her life. Books that in some cases had never even been translated into Spanish, but that she stocked anyway, not because she expected she'd ever sell them, but simply because it made her happy to know they were there. There were perhaps a dozen of these books stashed away on their ever-changing shelves, enduring among a cast of evolving neighbors. Now and again, when a book moved her, when a book opened a previously undiscovered window in her mind and forever altered her perception of the world, she would add it to those secret ranks. Once in a great while, she'd even try to recommend one of those books to a customer. She did this only when the customer was someone she knew and liked, someone she trusted to appreciate the value of the treasure being offered. She was almost always disappointed. In the 10 years she'd been doing this, only twice had Lydia experienced the pleasure of a customer approaching her counter with one of those books in hand, unsolicited. Twice in 10 years, there'd been a wild spark of wonder in the shop, when the bell above the door was like mistletoe, a possibility of something magical. So when Javier approached Lydia as she stood behind the register, perusing catalogs, when she lifted his selections from the counter to ring them up, she was astonished to find not one, but two of her secret treasures among them. Heart, You Bully, You Punk, by Leah Hager Cohen, and The Whereabouts of Ennius McNulty, by Sebastian Barry.
Oh my God, Lydia whispered.
Is something wrong? She looked up at him, realizing she hadn't actually looked at him yet, despite their cheerful banter earlier. He was fancily dressed for a Tuesday morning, in dark blue trousers and a white guayabera, an outfit more suitable for Sunday mass than a regular workday. And his thick black hair was parted sharply and combed to one side in an old-fashioned style. The heavy black plastic frames of his glasses were similarly outdated, so retro they were almost chic again. His eyes swam hugely behind the thick lenses, and his mustache quivered as she considered him. "These books," she said, "they're two of my favorites." It was an insufficient explanation, but all she could muster.
"Mine too," the man across from her said.
The mustache hitched ever so slightly with his hesitant smile.
"You've read them before?"
She was holding Heart, You Bully, You Punk with both hands.
"Well, only this one," he gestured to the one she was clutching.
She looked down at its cover. "You read in English?" she asked in English.